battlefield. You had a lot of little things killed, too, in the crossfire, little animals, many tiny graves. 24,000 men died at Shiloh in 2 days, I blurted. His eyes reverted to me in alarm. 50,000 at Gettysburg. It was the new weaponry. Mini-balls and repeating rifles. That was why the body count was so high. We had trench warfare in America way before World War I. Most people don't know that. I could see he had no idea what to do with this.
You're interested in the Civil War?
He said, after a careful pause.
Yes, I said brusquely. Kind of.
I knew a lot about Union field artillery, because I'd written a paper on it so technical and fact-jammed that the teacher had made me write it again, and I also knew about Brady's photographs of the dead at Antietam. I'd seen the pictures online, pin-eyed boys black with blood at the nose and mouth. Our class spent 6 weeks on Lincoln.
Brady had a photography studio not far from here. Have you ever seen it?
No. There had been a trapped thought about to emerge, something essential and unspeakable, released by the mention of those blank-faced soldiers. Now it was all gone but the image, dead boys with limbs akimbo, staring at the sky. The silence that followed this was excruciating. Neither of us seemed to know how to move forward. At last, Hobie recrossed his legs.
I mean to say, I'm sorry to press you, he said falteringly.
I squirmed. Coming downtown, I'd been so filled with curiosity that I'd failed to anticipate that I might be expected to answer any questions myself.
I know it must be difficult to talk about. It's just, I never thought.
My shoes. It was interesting how I'd never really looked at my shoes. The toe scuffs. The frayed laces. We'll go to Bloomingdale's Saturday and buy you a new pair. But that had never happened.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but he was aware.
Yes, sort of, I mean. His alert, anxious face made some remote part of me want to burst out with all kinds of stuff he didn't need to know and it wasn't right to tell him. Splattered insides. Ugly, repetitive flashes that broke in on my thoughts even while I was awake. Murky portraits, china spaniels on the mantelpiece, golden pendulum swinging, tockety-tock, tockety-tock. I heard him calling, rubbing my eye. When I woke up, it was like trying to explain a dream. You couldn't. And I went over to him, and I was with him, and it wasn't that bad. Or not like you'd think, I added, since this had come out sounding like the lie it was.
He spoke to you.
Swallowing hard, I nodded. Dark mahogany, potted palms.
He was conscious.
Again, I nodded. Bad taste in my mouth. It wasn't something you could summarize. Stuff that didn't make sense and didn't have a story. The dust, the alarms, how he'd held my hand. A whole lifetime there, just the two of us, mixed up sentences and names of towns and people I hadn't heard of, broken wires sparking. His eyes were still on me. My throat was dry and I felt a bit sick. The moment wasn't moving on to the next moment like it was supposed to, and I kept waiting for him to ask more questions, anything. But he didn't. At last he shook his head as if to clear it.
This is...
He seemed as confused as I was. The robe, the gray hair loose, gave him the look of a crownless king in a costume play for children.
I'm sorry, he said, shaking his head again. This is all so new.
Excuse me?
Well, you see, it's just...
He leaned forward and blinked, quick and agitated.
It's all very different. From what I was told, you see. They said he died instantly. Very, very emphatic on that point.
But, I stared, astonished. Did he think I was making it up?
No, no.
he said hastily, putting a hand up to reassure me. It's just, I'm sure it's what they say to everyone. Died instantly, he said bleakly, when still I stared at him.
Perfectly painless. Never knew what hit him.
Then, all at once, I did see the implication slithering in on me with a chill. My mother, too, had died instantly. Her death had been perfectly painless. The social workers had harped on it so insistently that I'd never thought to wonder how they could be quite so sure.
Although, I do have to say, it was difficult to imagine him going that way, Hobie said, in the abrupt silence that had fallen. The flash of lightning, falling over unawares, had a sense you do sometimes that it wasn't like they said, you know.
Sorry, I said, glancing up, disoriented by the vicious new possibility I'd stumbled into.
A goodbye at the gate, said Hobie.
He seemed to be talking partly to himself.
That's what he would have wanted. The parting glimpse. The death haiku. He wouldn't have liked to leave without stopping to speak to someone along the way. A tea house amid the cherry blossoms. On the way to death.
He had lost me. In the shadowy room, a single blade of sun pierced between the curtains and struck across the room where it caught and blazed up in a tray of cut glass decanters, casting prisms that flickered and shifted this way and that, and wavered high on the walls like paramecium's under a microscope. Though there was a strong smell of wood smoke, the fireplace was burnt out and black-looking, and the grate choked with ashes, as if the fires hadn't been lit in a while.
The girl, I said timidly.
His glance came back to me.
There was a girl, too.
For a moment, he did not seem to understand. Then he sat back in his chair and blinked rapidly as if water had been flicked in his face.
What?
I said, startled.
Where is she? She's okay?
No.
Rubbing the bridge of his nose.
No.
But she's alive?
I could hardly believe it. He raised his eyebrows in a way that I understood to mean, yes.
She was lucky.
But his voice and his manner seemed to say the opposite.
Is she here?
Well, where is she?
Can I see her?
He sighed, with something that looked like exasperation.
She's meant to be quiet, and not have visitors, he said, rummaging in his pockets. She's not herself. It's hard to know how she'll react.
But she's going to be all right?
Well, let us hope so. But she's not out of the woods yet, to employ the highly unclear phrase the doctors insist on using.
He'd taken cigarettes from the pocket of his bathrobe. With uncertain hands, he lit one, then with a flourish threw the pack on the painted Japanese table between us.
What?
He said, waving the smoke from his face when he caught me staring at the crumpled packet. French, like people smoked in old movies.
Don't tell me you want one, too.
No, thank you,
I said, after an uneasy silence. I was pretty sure he was joking, although I wasn't 100% sure. He, in return, was blinking at me sharply through the tobacco haze with a sort of worried look, as though he had just realized some crucial fact about me.
It's you, isn't it?
He said unexpectedly.
Excuse me?
You're the boy, aren't you? Whose mother died in there?
I was too stunned to say anything for a moment.
What?
I said, meaning, how do you know? But I couldn't quite get it out. Uncomfortably, he rubbed an eye and sat back suddenly, with the fluster of a man who's spilled a drink on the table.
Sorry, that didn't come out right. God, I'm...
Vaguely, he gestured as if to say I'm exhausted, not thinking straight. Not very politely, I looked away, blindsided by a queasy, unwelcome swell of emotion. Since my mother's death, I had cried hardly at all, and certainly not in front of anyone, not even at her memorial service, where people who barely knew her
and one or two who had made her life hell, such as Mathilde, were sobbing and blowing their noses all around me. He saw I was upset, started to say something, reconsidered.
"Have you eaten?"
he said unexpectedly. I was too surprised to answer. Food was the last thing on my mind.
"Ah, I thought not,"
he said, rising creakily to his big feet.
"Let's go rustle up something."
"I'm not hungry," I said, so rudely I was sorry. Since my mother's death, all anyone seemed to think of was shoveling food down my throat.
"No, no, of course not."
With his free hand, he fanned away a cloud of smoke.
"But come along, please. Humor me. You're not vegetarian, are you?"
"No," I said, offended.
"Why would you think that?"
He laughed, short, sharp.
"Easy. Lots of her friends are veg. So is she."
"Oh," I said faintly, and he looked down at me with a sort of lively, unhurried amusement.
"Well, just so you know, I'm not a vegetarian either," he said. "I'll eat any old sort of ridiculous thing. So I suppose we'll manage all right."
He pushed open a door, and I followed him down a crowded hallway lined with tarnished mirrors and old pictures. Though he was walking ahead of me fast, I was anxious to linger and look. Family groupings, white columns, verandas and palm trees, a tennis court, a Persian carpet spread on a lawn, male servants in white pajamas, solemnly abreast. My eye landed on Mr. Blackwell, beaky and personable, dapperly dressed in white, back hunched even in youth. He was lounging by a seaside retaining wall in some palmy locale. Beside him, atop the wall, hand on his shoulder and standing a head taller, smiled a kindergarten-aged Pippa. As tiny as she was, the resemblance sounded. Her coloring, her eyes, her head cocked at the same angle, and hair as red as his. "That's her, isn't it?" I said. At the same instant, I realized it couldn't possibly be her. This photo, with its faded colors and outmoded clothes, had been taken long before I was born. Hobie turned, came back to look.
"No," he said quietly, hands behind his back. "That's Juliet, Pippa's mother."
"Where's she?"
"Juliet, dead. Cancer. 6 years last May."
And then, seeming to realize he'd spoken too curtly,
"Welty was Juliet's big brother. Half-brother, rather. Same father, different wives, 30 years apart. But he brought her up like his own child."
I leaned in for a closer look. She was leaning against him, cheek inclined sweetly against the sleeve of his jacket. Hobie cleared his throat.
"She was born when their father was in his 60s, he said quietly. "Far too old to interest himself in a small child, particularly since he'd had no weakness for children to start with."
A door in the opposite side of the hallway stood ajar. He pushed it open and stood looking into darkness. On tiptoe, I craned behind, but almost immediately he backed away and clicked the door shut. "Is that her?" Though it had been too dark to see very much, I had caught the unfriendly glow of animal eyes, an unnerving greenish sheen from across the room.
"Not now."
His voice was so low I could barely hear him.
"What's that in there with her?"
I whispered, lingering by the doorway, reluctant to move along.
"A cat?"
"Dog. The nurse doesn't approve. But she wants him in the bed with her, and honestly, I can't keep him out. He scratches at the door and whines. Here, this way."
Moving slowly, creakily, with an old person's forward-leaning quality, he pushed open a door into a crowded kitchen with a ceiling skylight and a curvaceous old stove, tomato red, with svelte lines like a 1950s spaceship. Books stacked on the floor, cookbooks, dictionaries, old novels, encyclopedias, shelves closely packed with antique china in half a dozen patterns. Near the window, by the fire escape, a faded wooden saint held up a palm in benediction. On the sideboard, alongside a silver tea set, painted animals straggled two by two into a Noah's Ark. But the sink was piled with dishes, and on the countertops and windowsills stood medicine bottles, dirty cups, alarming drifts of unopened mail, and plants from the florists dry and brown in their pots. He sat me down at the table, pushing away Con Ed bills and back issues of Antiques magazine. "Tea," he said, as if remembering an item on a grocery list. As he busied himself at the stove, I stared at the coffee rings on the tablecloth. Restlessly, I pushed back in my chair and looked around. I said.
"Yes?
Can I see her later?"
"Maybe,"
he said, with his back to me. Whisk beat against blue china bowl. Tap, tap, tap.
"If she's awake. She's in a good deal of pain, and the medicine makes her sleepy."
"What happened to her?"
"Well."
His tone was at once brisk and subdued, and I recognized it at once since it was much the tone I employed when people asked about my mother.
"She's had a bad crack on the head, a skull fracture. To tell you the truth, she was in a coma for a while, and her left leg was broken in so many pieces, she came near to losing it." "Marbles in a sock," he said, with a mirthless laugh. "That's what the doctor said when he looked at the X-ray. 12 breaks, 5 surgeries. Last week," he said, half turning, "she had the pins out, and she begged so to come home, they said she could, as long as we had a nurse part-time."
"Is she walking yet?"
"Goodness, no," he said,
bringing his cigarette up for a drag. He was somehow managing to cook with one hand and smoke with the other, like some tugboat captain or lumber camp cook in an old movie.
"She can hardly sit up more than half an hour."
"But she'll be fine."
"Well, that's what we hope,"
he said, in what did not seem an overly hopeful tone.
"You know,"
he said, glancing back at me,
"if you were in there too, it's remarkable that you're okay."
"Well, I never knew how to respond when people commented, as they often did, on my being okay." Hobie coughed and put out the cigarette.
"Well,"
I could see from his expression that he knew he'd disturbed me and was sorry.
"I suppose they spoke to you too? The investigators?"
I looked at the tablecloth.
"Yes."
The less said about this, I felt, the better.
"Well, I don't know about you, but I found them very decent, very informed. This one Irishman, he'd seen a lot of these things he was telling me about, suitcase bombs in England and in the Paris airport, some sidewalk cafe thing in Tangier, you know. Dozens dead, and the person right next to the bomb isn't hurt at all. He said they see some pretty strange effects, you know, in older buildings especially. Enclosed spaces, uneven surfaces, reflective materials, very unpredictable. Just like acoustics, he said. The blast waves are like sound waves. They bounce and deflect. Sometimes you have shop windows broken miles off, or..."
He pushed the hair out of his eyes with his wrist.
"Sometimes, closer to hand, there's what he called a shielding effect. Things very close to the detonation remain intact. The unbroken teacup in the blown-out IRA cottage, or what have you. It's the flying glass and debris that kills most people, you know. Often at pretty far range. A pebble or a piece of glass at that speed is as good as a bullet."
I traced my thumb along the flower pattern of the tablecloth.
Sorry. Maybe not the right thing to talk about."
"No, no," I said hurriedly. It was actually a huge relief to hear someone speak directly and in an informed way about what most people tied themselves in knots to avoid.
"That's not it. It's just..."
"Yes?"
"I was wondering, how'd she get out?" "Well, it was a stroke of luck. She was trapped under a lot of rubbish. The firemen wouldn't have found her if one of the dogs hadn't alerted. They worked part way in, jacked up the beam. I mean, the amazing thing, too, she was awake. Talked to them the whole time, though she doesn't remember a bit of it. The miracle of it was they got her out before the call came to evacuate. How long were you knocked out, did you say?
I don't remember.
Well, you were lucky. If they'd had to go off and leave her there, still pinned, which I understand did happen to some people.
Ah, here we go, he said as the teapot whistled. The plate of food, when he set it before me, was nothing to look at. Puffy yellow stuff on toast. But it smelled good. Cautiously, I tasted it. It was melted cheese, with chopped up tomato and cayenne pepper and some other things I couldn't figure out. And it was delicious.
Sorry, what is this?
I said, taking another careful bite. He looked a bit embarrassed.
Well, it doesn't really have a name.
It's good, I said, slightly astonished how hungry I really was. My mother had made a cheese on toast, very similar which we ate sometimes on Sunday nights in winter.
You like cheese? I should have thought to ask.
I nodded, mouth too full to answer. Even though Mrs. Barber was always pressing ice cream and sweets on me, somehow it felt as if I'd hardly eaten a normal meal since my mother died. At least, not the kind of meals that had been normal for us. Stir-fry or scrambled eggs, or macaroni and cheese from the box, while I sat on the kitchen stepladder and told her about my day. As I ate, he sat across the table with his chin in his big white hands.
What are you good at?
He asked rather suddenly.
Sports?
Sorry?
What are you interested in? Games and all that?
Well, video games, like Age of Conquest?
Yakuza Freakout?
He seemed nonplussed.
What about school, then? Favorite subject?
History, I guess. English, too, I said when he didn't answer. But English is going to be really boring for the next 6 weeks. We stopped doing literature and went back to the grammar book, and now we're diagramming sentences.
Literature? English or American?
American, right now. Or we were. American history, too, this year. Although it's been really boring lately. We're just getting off the Great Depression, but it'll be good again once we get to World War II. It was the most enjoyable conversation I'd had in a while. He asked me all kinds of interesting questions, like what I'd read in literature and how middle school was different from elementary school. What was my hardest subject? Spanish. And what was my favorite historical period? I wasn't sure. Anything but Eugene Debs and the history of labor, which we'd spent way too much time on. And what did I want to be when I grew up? No clue. But still, it was refreshing to converse with a grown-up who seemed interested in me apart from my misfortune, not prying for information or running down a checklist of things to say to troubled kids. We'd gotten off on the subject of writers, from T.H. White and Tolkien to Edgar Allan Poe, another favorite. My dad says Poe's a second-rate writer, I said, that he's the Vincent Price of American letters, but I don't think that's fair.
No, it isn't, said Hobie, seriously, pouring himself a cup of tea. Even if you don't like Poe, he invented the detective story and science fiction. In essence, he invented a huge part of the 20th century. I mean, honestly, I don't care as much for him as I did when I was a boy, but even if you don't like him, you can't dismiss him as a crank.
My dad did. He used to go around reciting Annabel Lee in a stupid voice to make me mad, because he knew I liked it.
Your dad's a writer, then?
No. I didn't know where he'd gotten that. An actor. Or he was. Before I was born, he'd played guest roles on several TV shows. Never the star, but the star's spoiled playboy friend or corrupt business partner who gets killed.
Would I have heard of him?
No. Now he works in an office. Or he did.
And what's he doing now, then?
He asked. He had slipped the ring over his little finger, and from time to time he twisted it between thumb and forefinger of his other hand, as if to make sure it was still there. Who knows? He ditched us. To my surprise,
He laughed.
Good riddance?
Well, I shrugged. I don't know. Sometimes he was okay. We'd watch sports and cop shows, and he'd tell me how they did the special effects with the blood and all. But it's like, I don't know, like, sometimes he was drunk when he came to pick me up from school. I hadn't really talked about this with Dave the Shrink or Mrs. Swanson or anyone. I was scared to tell my mother, but then one of the other mothers told her. And then, it was a long story. I was feeling embarrassed. I wanted to cut it short. He got his hand broken in a bar. He was fighting somebody in a bar. He had this bar he liked to go to every day. Only we didn't know that's where he was because he said he was working late. And he had this whole set of friends we didn't know about, and they sent him postcards when they went on vacation to places like the Virgin Islands, to our home address, which was how we found out about it. And my mother tried to make him go to AA, but he wouldn't go. Sometimes the doorman used to come and stand in the hall outside the apartment and make a lot of noise so he could hear them. So he knew they were out there, you know, so he didn't get too out of hand.
Out of hand?
There was a lot of yelling and stuff. It was mostly him doing it, but uncomfortably aware that I'd said more than I meant to. It was mainly him making a bunch of noise, like, oh, I don't know, like when he had to stay with me, when she had to work, he was always in a really bad mood. I couldn't talk to him when he was watching news or sports. That was the rule. I mean, I paused, unhappily, feeling I'd talked myself into a corner. Anyway, that was a long time ago. He sat back in his chair and looked at me. A big, self-contained, guarded man, though his eyes were the worried blue of boyishness.
And now, he said, do you like the people you're staying with?
I paused with full mouth, at a loss how to explain the barbers.
They're nice, I guess. I'm glad. I mean, I can't say I know Samantha Barber, although I've done some work for her family in the past. She has a good eye.
At this, I stopped eating. You know the barbers?
Not him. Her. Though his mother was quite a collector, I gather it all went to the brother, though. Due to some family quarrel. Welty would have been able to tell you more about it. Not that he was a gossip, he added hastily. Welty was very discreet, buttoned up to here. But people confided in him. He was that sort, you know. Strangers opened up to him. Clients, people he hardly knew. He was the kind of man people like to entrust with their sadnesses. But yes, he folded his hands. Every art dealer and antiquario in New York knows Samantha Barber. She was a Vanderplane before she married. Not a great buyer, though Welty saw her at auction sometimes, and she certainly has some pretty things.
Who told you I was staying with the Barbers? He blinked rapidly.
It was in the paper, he said. You didn't see it?
The paper?
The Times. You didn't read it? No?
There was something in the paper about me?
No, no, he said quickly. Not about you. About children who had lost family members in the museum. Most of them were tourists. There was one little girl, a baby, really. Diplomat's child from South America.
What did they say about me in the paper? He made a face.
Oh, an orphan's plight. Charity-minded socialite steps in, that kind of thing. You can imagine.
I stared into my plate, feeling embarrassed.
Orphan? Charity? It was a very nice piece. I gather you protected one of her sons from bullies?
He said, lowering his large gray head to catch my eye.
At school? The other gifted boy who was put ahead?
I shook my head.
Sorry? Samantha's son, whom you defended from a group of older boys at school, took beatings for him, that kind of thing.
Again, I shook my head, completely bewildered. He laughed.
Such modesty! You shouldn't be embarrassed.
But it wasn't like that, I said, baffled. We both got picked on and beaten up. Every day.
So the story said, which made it all the more remarkable that you stood up for him. A broken bottle, he said when I didn't respond. Someone was trying to cut Samantha Barber's son with a broken bottle, and you...
Oh, that, I said, embarrassed. That was nothing.
You were cut yourself when you tried to help him.
That's not how it happened. Kavanaugh jumped on both of us. There was a piece of broken glass on the sidewalk.
Again, he laughed. A big man's laugh, rich and rough and at odds with his carefully cultivated voice.
Well, however it happened, he said, you've certainly tipped up in an interesting family.
Standing, he went to the cupboard, where he retrieved a bottle of whiskey and poured a couple of fingers in a not very clean glass.
Samantha Barber doesn't seem the warmest and most welcoming of heart. At least that's not the impression, he said. Yet she seems to do an awful lot of good in the world with the foundations and fundraising, doesn't she?
I kept quiet as he put the bottle back in the cupboard. Above, through the skylight, the light was gray and opalescent. A fine rain peppered at the glass.
Are you going to open the shop again?
I said.
Well, he sighed. Welty handled all that end of it. The clients, the sales. Me, I'm a cabinet maker, not a businessman. Brocanteur, bricoleur. Barely set foot up there. I'm always below stairs, sanding and polishing. Now he's gone. Well, it's still very new. People calling for things he sold. Things still being delivered. I never knew he bought. Don't know where the paperwork is. Don't know who any of it's for. There are a million things I need to ask him. I'd give anything if I could talk to him for 5 minutes. Particularly as regards Pippa. Her medical care and... Well,
right, I said, aware how lame I sounded.
We were heading into the clumsy territory of my mother's funeral. Stretched out silences, wrong smiles, the place where words didn't work.
He was a lovely man. Not many like him. Gentle, charming. People always felt sorry for him because of his back, though I'd never met anyone so naturally gifted with a happy disposition. And of course, the customers loved him. Outgoing fellow, very sociable, always was. The world won't come to me, he used to say. So I must go to it.
Quite suddenly, Andy's iPhone chimed. Text message coming in. Hobie, glass halfway to his mouth, started violently.
What was that?
Wait a second,
I said, digging in my pocket. The text was from Phil Lefkow, one of the kids in Andy's Japanese class.
Hi, Theo. Andy here. Are you okay?
Hastily, I switched the phone off and stuck it back in my pocket.
Sorry, I said. What were you saying?
I forget.
He stared into space for a moment or two, then shook his head.
I never thought I'd see this again,
he said, looking down at the ring.
So like him to ask you to bring it here, to put it in my hand. I didn't say anything, but I thought for sure someone had pocketed it at the morgue.
Again, the phone chimed its annoying, high-pitched note.
Gosh, sorry,
I said, scrambling for it. Andy's text read,
just making sure you're not being killed. Sorry,
I said, holding the button down just to make sure. It really is off this time. But he only smiled and looked into his glass. Rain tapped and dripped at the skylight, casting watery shadows that streamed down the wall. Too shy to say anything, I waited for him to pick up the thread again, and when he didn't, we sat there peacefully while I sipped my cooling tea, Lapsang Souchong, smoky and peculiar, and felt the strangeness of my life and where I was. I pushed my plate aside. Thank you, I said dutifully, eyes wandering round the room. That was really good. Speaking, as had become my habit, for my mother's benefit, in case she was listening.
Oh, how polite, he said.
laughing at me but not unkindly, in a way that felt friendly.
Do you like it?
What?
My Noah's Ark.
He nodded at the shelf.
You were looking at it over there, I thought.
The worn wooden animals, elephants, tigers, oxen, zebras, all the way down to a tiny pair of mice, stood patiently in line, waiting to board.
Is it hers?
I asked, after a fascinated silence. For the animals were so lovingly positioned, the big cats ignoring each other, the male peacock turned away from his hen to admire his reflection in the toaster. I could imagine her spending hours arranging them and trying to get them exactly right.
No.
His hands came together on the table.
It was one of the first antiques I ever bought, 30 years ago, in an American folk sale. I'm not a great one for the folk art, never have been. This piece, not of the first quality, doesn't fit with anything else I own, and yet it's the inappropriate thing. The thing that doesn't quite work, that's oddly the dearest.
I pushed back in my chair, unable to keep my feet still.
Can I see her now?
I said.
If she's awake.
He pursed his lips.
Well, don't see the harm, but only for a minute, mind.
When he stood, his bulky, stoop-shouldered height took me by surprise all over again.
I warn you, though, she's a bit muddled.
Oh,
he turned in the doorway. And best not to bring up Welty, if you can help it.
She doesn't know?
Oh, yes.
His voice was brisk.
She knows. But sometimes when she hears it, she gets upset all over again. Asks when it happened and why nobody told her.
2. When he opened the door, the shades were down, and it took my eyes a moment to adjust to the dark, which was aromatic and perfume-smelling, with an undertone of sickness and medicine. Over the bed hung a framed poster from the movie of The Wizard of Oz. A scented candle guttered in a red glass, among trinkets and rosaries, sheet music, tissue paper flowers, and old valentines, along with what looked like hundreds of get-well cards strung up on ribbons, and a bunch of silver balloons hovering ominously at the ceiling, metallic strings hanging down long like jellyfish stingers.
"Someone here to see you, Pip,"
said Hobie in a loud and cheerful tone. I saw the coverlet stir. An elbow went up.
Said
a sleepy voice.
It's so dark, my dear. Won't you let me open the curtains?
No, please don't. The light hurts my eyes.
She was smaller than I remembered, and her face, a blur in the gloom, was very white. Head shaven, all but a single lock in front. As I drew closer, a bit fearfully, I saw a glint of metal at her temple, a barrette or hairpin, I thought, before I made out the steel medical staples in a vicious coil above one ear.
I heard you in the hallway,
she said in a small, raspy voice, looking between me and Hobie.
Heard what, Pigeon?
Said Hobie.
Heard you talking. Cosmo did too.
At first I didn't see the dog, and then I did. A gray terrier curled alongside her, amidst the pillows and stuffed toys. When he raised his head, I saw from his grizzled face and cataract-clouded eyes that he was very old.
I thought you were asleep, Pigeon,
Hobie was saying, reaching out to scratch the dog's chin.
You always say that, but I'm always awake. Hi,
she said, looking up at me.
Hi. Who are you?
My name's Theo.
What's your favorite piece of music?
I don't know, I said, and then, so as not to appear stupid, Beethoven.
That's great. You look like somebody who would like Beethoven.
I do, I said, feeling overwhelmed.
I meant that in a nice way. I can't listen to music because of my head. It's completely horrible. No.
She said to Hobie, who was clearing books and gauze and Kleenex packets out of the bedside chair so I could sit down in it.
Let him sit here. You can sit here,
she said to me, shifting over slightly in the bed to make room. After a glance back at Hobie to make sure it was okay, I sat down, gingerly, with one hip, careful not to disturb the dog, who raised his head and glared.
Don't worry. He won't bite. Well, sometimes he bites.
She looked at me with drowsy eyes.
I know you.
You remember me?
Are we friends?
Yes, I said without thinking, and then glanced back at Hobie, embarrassed I'd lied.
I forgot your name. I'm sorry. I remember your face, though.
Then, stroking the dog's head, she said,
I didn't remember my room when I came home. I remembered my bed and all my stuff, but the room was different.
Now that my eyes had adjusted to the dark, I saw the wheelchair in the corner, the bottles of medicine on the table by her bed.
What Beethoven do you like?
I was staring at her arm, resting atop the coverlet, the tender skin on the inside of her arm with a band-aid in the crook of the elbow. She was pushing up in bed, looking past me to Hobie, silhouetted in the bright doorway.
I'm not supposed to talk too much, am I?
She said.
No, Pigeon.
I don't think I'm too tired, but I can't tell. Do you get tired during the day?
She asked me.
Sometimes.
After my mother's death, I had developed a tendency to fall asleep in class and conk out in Andy's room after school.
I never used to. I do, too. I feel sleepy all the time now. I wonder why. I think it's so boring.
Hobie, I noticed, looking back at the lighted doorway, had stepped away for a moment. Although it was very unlike me, for some strange reason I had been itching to reach out and take her hand, and now that we were alone, I did.
You don't mind, do you?
I asked her. Everything seemed slow, like I was moving through deep water. It was very strange to be holding somebody's hand, a girl's hand, and yet oddly normal. I had never done anything of the sort before.
Not at all. I think it's nice.
Then, after a brief pause, during which I could hear the little terrier snoring, she said,
You don't mind if I close my eyes for a few seconds, do you?
No, I said, running a thumb over her knuckles, tracing the bones.
I know it's rude, but I just absolutely have to.
I looked down at her shaded eyelids, chapped lips, pallor and bruises, the ugly hash mark of metal over one ear. The strange combination of what was exciting about her and what wasn't supposed to be made me feel lightheaded and confused. Guilty, I glanced back and noticed Hobie standing in the door. Tiptoeing out to the hall again, I closed the door quietly behind me, grateful that the hall was so dark. Together, we walked back through to the parlor.
How does she seem to you?
He said, in a voice so low I could hardly hear him. What was I supposed to say to that? Okay, I guess.
She's not herself.
He paused, unhappily, with his hands dug deep into the pockets of the bathrobe.
That is, she is and she isn't. She doesn't recognize a lot of people who were close to her. Speaks to them very formally, and yet sometimes she's very open with strangers, very chatty and familiar. People she's never seen before. Treats them like old friends. Quite common, I'm told.
Why isn't she supposed to listen to music? He raised an eyebrow.
Oh, she does, sometimes. But sometimes, late in the day especially, it tends to upset her. She thinks she has to practice, that she has to prepare a piece for school. She gets distraught. Very difficult. As far as playing on some amateur level, that's perfectly possible someday. Or so they tell me.
Quite suddenly the doorbell rang, startling us both.
Ah, said Hobie, looking distressed, glancing at what I noticed was an extremely beautiful old wristwatch. That'll be her nurse.
We looked at each other. We weren't finished talking. There was so much still to say. Again, the doorbell rang. Down the hall, the dog was barking.
"She's early," said Hobie, hurrying through, looking a bit desperate.
"Can I come back to see her?" He stopped. He seemed appalled that I had even asked.
"But of course you can come back," he said. "Please come back."
Again, the doorbell.
"Any time you like," said Hobie. "Please. We're always glad to see you."
3.
"So, what happened down there?"
said Andy, as we were dressing for dinner.
"Was it weird?"
Platt had left to catch the train back to school. Mrs. Barber had a supper with the board of some charity, and Mr. Barber was taking the rest of us out to dinner at the yacht club, where we only went on nights when Mrs. Barber had something else to do.
"He knew your mother, the guy."
Andy, nodding his necktie, made a face. "Everybody knew his mother."
"It was a little weird," I said, "but it's good I went."
"Here," I said, fishing in my jacket pocket.
"Thanks for your phone."
Andy checked it for messages, then switched it off and slipped it in his pocket. Pausing, with his hands still in the pocket, he looked up, not straight at me.
"I know things are bad," he said unexpectedly. "I'm sorry everything is so fucked up for you now."
His voice, as flat as the robot voice on an answering machine, kept me for a moment from realizing quite what he'd said.
"She was awfully nice," he said, still without looking at me. "I mean,
yeah, well," I muttered, not anxious to continue the conversation.
"I mean, I miss her,"
Andy said, meeting my eye with a sort of half-terrified look.
"I never knew anybody that died before. Well, my Grandpa Vanderplane, never anybody I liked."
I said nothing. My mother had always had a soft spot for Andy, patiently drawing him out about his home weather station, teasing him about his galactic battleground scores until he went bright red with pleasure. Young, playful, fun-loving, affectionate. She had been everything his own mother wasn't. A mother who threw frisbees with us in the park and discussed zombie movies with us and let us lie around in her bed on Saturday mornings to eat Lucky Charms and watch cartoons. And it had annoyed me sometimes, a little, how goofy and exhilarated he was in her presence, trotting behind her, babbling about level 4 of whatever game he was on, unable to tear his eyes from her rear end when she was bending to get something from the fridge.
"She was the coolest,"
said Andy, in his faraway voice.
"Do you remember when she took us on the bus to that horror fan convention way out in New Jersey? And that creep named Rip, who kept following us around trying to get her to be in his vampire movie?"
He meant well, I knew, but it was almost unbearable for me to talk about anything to do with my mother, or before, and I turned my head away.
"I don't think he was even a horror person,"
Andy said in his faint, annoying voice.
"I think he was some kind of fetishist. All that dungeon stuff with the girls strapped to the laboratory tables was pretty much straight-up bondage porn. Do you remember him begging her to try on those vampire teeth?"
"Yeah, that was when she went up to talk to the security guard."
"Leather pants, all those piercings. I mean, who knows, maybe he really was making a vampire film, but he was definitely a huge perv. Did you notice that? Like, that sneaky smile? And the way he kept trying to look down her top?"
I gave him the finger. "Come on, let's go," I said. "I'm hungry."
"Oh, yes?"
I'd lost 9 or 10 pounds since my mother died. Enough weight that Mrs. Swanson, embarrassingly, had started weighing me in her office on the scale she used for girls with eating disorders. "What, you're not?"
"Yeah, but I thought you were watching your weight, so you'd fit in your prom dress."
"Fuck you," I said good-naturedly as I opened the door, and walked straight into Mr. Barber, who had been standing right outside, whether eavesdropping or about to knock, it was hard to say. Mortified, I began to stammer. Swearing was seriously against the rules at the barber's house, but Mr. Barber didn't seem overly perturbed.
"Well, Theo," he said dryly, looking over my head, "I'm certainly glad to hear that you're feeling better. Come along now.
and let's go get a table.
4. During the next week, everyone noticed that my appetite had improved, even Toddy.
Are you done with your hunger strike?
He asked me curiously one morning.
Toddy, eat your breakfast.
But I thought that was what it was called, when people don't eat.
No, a hunger strike is for people in prison,
Kitsy said coolly.
Kitten, said Mr. Barber in a warning tone.
Yes, but he ate 3 waffles yesterday,
said Toddy, looking eagerly between his uninterested parents in an attempt to engage them.
I only ate 2 waffles, and this morning he ate a bowl of cereal and 6 pieces of bacon, but you said 5 pieces of bacon was too much for me. Why can't I have 5 pieces, too?
5.
Well, hello there. Greetings, said Dave the psychiatrist, as he closed the door and took a seat across from me in his office.
Killam rugs, shelves filled with old textbooks, drugs and society, child psychology, a different approach, and beige draperies that parted with a hum when you pushed a button. I smiled, awkwardly, eyes going all around the room, potted palm tree, bronze statue of the Buddha, everywhere but him.
So,
the faint traffic drone floating up from First Avenue made the silence between us seem vast, intergalactic.
How's everything today?
Well, I dreaded my sessions with Dave, a twice-weekly ordeal not incomparable to dental surgery. I felt guilty for not liking him more since he made such an effort, always asking what movies I enjoyed, what books, burning me CDs, clipping articles from GamePro he thought I'd be interested in. Sometimes he even took me over to EJ's Luncheonette for a hamburger. And yet whenever he started with the questions, I froze stiff, as if I'd been pushed on stage in a play where I didn't know the lines.
You seem a little distracted today.
It had not escaped me that a number of the books on Dave's shelves had titles with the word sex in them. Adolescent sexuality, sex and cognition, patterns of sexual deviance, and, my favorite, out of the shadows, understanding sexual addiction.
I'm okay, I guess.
You guess?
No, I'm fine. Things are good.
Oh, yeah? Dave leaned back in his chair, Converse sneaker bobbing.
That's great.
Then,
why don't you bring me up to speed a little bit on what's been going on?
Oh, I scratched my eyebrow, looked away.
Spanish is still pretty difficult.
I have another makeup test. I'll probably take that Monday. But I got an A on my Stalingrad paper, so it looks like that'll bring my B- in history up to a B. He was quiet so long looking at me that I began to feel cornered and started casting around for something else to say. Then,
anything else?
Well, I looked at my thumbs.
How's your anxiety been?
Not so bad, I said, thinking how uneasy it made me that I didn't know a thing about Dave. He was one of those guys who wore a wedding ring that didn't really look like a wedding ring. Or maybe it wasn't a wedding ring at all and he was just super proud of his Celtic heritage. If I'd had to guess, I would have said he was newly married, with a baby. He gave off a glazed vibe of exhausted young fatherhood, like he might have to get up and change diapers in the night. But who knew?
And your medication? What about the side effects?
I scratched my nose.
Better, I guess.
I hadn't even been taking my pills, which made me so tired and headachy I'd started spitting them down the plug hole of the bathroom sink. Dave was quiet for a moment.
So, would it be out of line to say that you're feeling better, generally?
I guess not, I said, after a silence, staring at the wall hanging behind his head. It looked like a lopsided abacus made of clay beads and knotted rope, and I had spent what felt like a massive portion of my recent life staring at it. Dave smiled.
You say that like it's something to be ashamed of. But feeling better doesn't mean you've forgotten about your mother, or that you loved her any less.
Resenting this supposition, which had never occurred to me, I looked away from him and out the window, at his depressing view of the white brick building across the street.
Do you have any idea why you might be feeling better?
No, not really, I said curtly. Better wasn't even the word for how I felt. There wasn't a word for it.
It was more that things too small to mention. Laughter in the hall at school. A live gecko scurrying in a tank in the science lab. Made me feel happy one moment, and the next like crying. Sometimes in the evenings, a damp, gritty wind blew in the windows from Park Avenue, just as the rush hour traffic was thinning and the city was emptying for the night. It was rainy, trees leafing out, spring deepening into summer, and the forlorn cry of horns on the street. The dank smell of the wet pavement had an electricity about it, a sense of crowds and static, lonely secretaries and fat guys with bags of carryout, everywhere the ungainly sadness of creatures pushing and struggling to live. For weeks, I'd been frozen, sealed off. Now, in the shower, I would turn up the water as hard as it would go and howl, silently. Everything was raw and painful and confusing and wrong. And yet it was as if I'd been dragged from freezing water through a break in the ice into sun and blazing cold.
Where did you go just now?
Said Dave, attempting to catch my eye.
Sorry. What were you just thinking about?
Nothing.
Oh, yeah?
Pretty hard to think about absolutely nothing. I shrugged. Aside from Andy, I told no one about going down on the bus to Pippa's house, and the secret colored everything, like the afterglow of a dream. Tissue paper poppies, dim light from a guttering candle, the sticky heat of her hand in mine. But though it was the most resonant and real-seeming thing that had happened in a long time, I didn't want to spoil it by talking about it, especially not with him. We sat there for another long moment or two. Then Dave leaned forward with a concerned expression and said,
You know, when I ask you where you go during these silences, Theo, I'm not trying to be a jerk or put you on the spot or anything.
Oh, sure, I know, I said uneasily, picking at the tweed upholstery on the arm of the sofa.
I'm here to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Or, creak of wood as he shifted in his chair,
we don't have to talk at all. Only I wonder if you have something on your mind.
Well, I said, after another never-ending pause, resisting the temptation to peek sideways at my watch.
I mean, I just... How many more minutes did we have? 40? Because I hear from some of the other adults in your life that you've had a noticeable upswing of late. You've been participating in class more, he said when I didn't answer. Engaging socially? Eating normal meals again?
In the stillness, an ambulance siren floated up faintly from the street.
So I guess I'm wondering if you could help me understand what's changed.
I shrugged, scratched the side of my face. How are you supposed to explain this kind of thing? It seemed stupid to try. Even the memory was starting to seem vague and starry with unreality, like a dream where the details get fainter the harder you try to grasp them. What mattered more was the feeling, a rich, sweet undertow so commanding that in class, on the school bus, lying in bed trying to think of something safe or pleasant, some environment or configuration where my chest wasn't tight with anxiety, all I had to do was sink into the blood-warm current and let myself spin away to the secret place where everything was all right. Cinnamon-colored walls, rain on the window panes, vast quiet and a sense of depth and distance, like the varnish over the background of a 19th-century painting. Rugs worn to threads, painted Japanese fans and antique valentines flickering in candlelight, pierrots and doves and flower-garlanded hearts, Pippa's face pale in the dark.
6.
Listen, I said to Andy several days later as we were coming out of Starbucks after school. Can you cover for me this afternoon?
Certainly, said Andy, taking a greedy swallow of his coffee. How long?
Don't know.
Depending on how long it took me to change trains at 14th Street, it might take 45 minutes to get downtown. The bus on a weekday would be even longer.
3 hours?
He made a face.